This morning reading is from Mark 8, 14 to 21, the new leaven. The disciples had forgotten to bring bread except one loaf that they had with them in the boat. "Be careful," Jesus warned them. "Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod." They discussed this with one another and said, "Is it because we have no bread?" Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, "Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see, and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember when I have broken the five loaves for the 5,000, and how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up?" 12, they replied. "And when I broke the seven loaves for 4,000, how many baskets full of pieces did you pick up?" They answered, 7. And he said to them, "Do you still not understand?" Now, where did my story go? Oh, here it is. I'm sorry. Whack! Right on the head with a rolled up newspaper. "What was that for?" the husband shouted. "That," his wife said, was for a piece of paper I found with the name Laura Sue on it. "But dear," he says, "that was just the name of a horse I bet on when I went to the track." "Okay," she says, "I'll let it go this time." 2 weeks later, whack! "Now what?" he wails. "Your horse called." That one tickled me a little bit too. This morning's message is centered around the use of the word leaven, or in some cases yeast. It's the same thing. President Trump has coined a phrase, or he uses it, and he calls it fake news. A lot of fake news. Everything is fake news. Some would think that whatever he calls fake news is things that people that have a different opinion from his. Jesus would say, "Beware of President Trump's leaven." No matter where you stand on the political aisle, there is fake news or leaven that we should be aware of. There seems to be a lot of that going on. The use of the word leaven has had a long journey in the Bible. It didn't always start out in the beginning as being something bad. It eventually worked its way to being that. Leaven, as you know, is used in bread. And some of the earliest known bread with leaven is about 4,000 years B.C., and the Egyptians used it. They didn't go down to the local store and buy some yeast and put it in their bread. They had different ways of doing it. And so one of the ways was the Gauls and the Liberians, they used to use the foam that was skimmed off the top of beer. That would what they would use it to start the leaven process. The leaven process is basically what you put in bread or whatever, so it rises up and makes it something more than what it is. Sourdough was used for many, many years, and you had to like save a batch of your sourdough to start the next day, and it was used in various forms. So you always had some left over. A great must. I had to look up what that was. Must. Grape must. Does anybody know what grape must is? Well, I didn't either. So it's young wine with skins and seeds in it, all crushed together. It's called must. And that they mix with flour to start the fermenting process. So you can use. I guess they squeeze that, and that juice activates like a yeast. I thought that was very interesting how they could, they basically just throw the whole grape in it And that's what starts the process. And basically what you're doing is starting a process of fermenting in your bread is what you want to do in order to make it rise up. Another form was wheat bran. And in a wine source, they would use that to start the leaven process. So it wasn't like we do today, and we go down to the local store. And I can remember my mother, she used to have this little cube about the size of a butter stick, a half a butter stick, and she would slice it off and put it in. So she always used like the mushy kind. It wasn't in a dry form in a little bag. I called it a mushy form. Did you ever taste it? It's not real tasty. My curiosity got me down one day, and I can remember tasting it, and it's not real tasty. But anyway, leaven, and unleavened bread was used a lot of times in a lot of spiritual meanings and spiritual celebrations along the way. And so it was used in the Mosaic law to depict sin in some way. But that process took a process also. The Feast of Weeks or the Feast of Unleavened Bread, in which they had 7 days or 6 days, 6 or 7 days in which they had to eat unleavened bread as part of the celebration. It was part of Passover. And what had happened, which we probably all know the story, when Moses was leading the children of Israel out of Egypt, they were commanded to make bread, and they didn't have time to let it raise, and so they baked it as a little cracker wafer. I often wondered, do you have to bake it to a cracker, or can it be like a soft, thin something? I'm not really sure. But anyway, they baked it, and that's all they had time for. And of course, they put blood over the lentils and all that kind of stuff. And so that started the celebration of Passover process. And so they were commanded by Yahweh, the God of Israel, to celebrate that time when they left Egypt. And so they had to have 7 days when they would go through the whole house and they would get rid of leaven out of the house. They had to move it all out of the house. My brother, who is a Messianic, who celebrates these celebrations, still does that. He is part of that. They go through their house and get all the leaven out of the house in order to celebrate. But it wasn't just as easy as going to the refrigerator and taking that chunk of yeast out of your refrigerator to setting it outside. As various different forms of how leaven was, or the process was, you had to get rid of all that, whatever you used to leaven your bread. So it wasn't quite so easy. You might have had a secret bottle sitting over in the corner somewhere that you had to get rid of, that you used in the process, wine and something else, and you had to get rid of that. So they had an effort to go around their whole house, and they had to get rid of it for 7 days. And that they had to eat unleavened bread as a reminder of their flight out of Egypt. And that became a celebration. So it became sin in the sense of that you were breaking the law, Mosaic law, if you ate leavened bread during this time. And so through time, the word leaven has meant throughout the Bible, up until Jesus' time, which I'm going to get to, meant that it was depicted sin. Unleavened bread was considered to be, if you wanted to be more righteous in the time of celebration. The first mention of unleavened bread that I ran across in the Bible, I used my Strong's to research this and whatnot, was when Lot and the angels came down. And when Lot was living in Sodom and Gomorrah, and Lot wanted the angels to come into his house, the messengers of God, the angel of the Lord, and I will add something that, a little sideline here for whatever. I heard on my religious channel or on my satellite radio, the angel of the Lord to this particular pastor was a pre-incarnate Jesus. I do not believe that to be the case. I'm sorry. I think that's an effort. You will hear that if you listen to preachers off and on. You will hear that the angel of the Lord is considered to be the pre-incarnate of Jesus, which it don't make no sense to me. But it's an effort to Christianize the Old Testament so that it fits in their parameter. I don't try to do that. I like to read it for what it's worth. Anyway, these three messengers, I think it was three or two messengers, came to Lot to warn Lot to get out of town. And Lot wanted to entertain them with a meal. They didn't necessarily want to come in, but Lot insisted. He said, "You sit right here and wait, and I'll go get you a meal." And so in order to, he didn't have any fresh bread, so he made unleavened bread, which he didn't have time for it to let it rise and do all that. And so he served them unleavened bread and a small goat. And that was the first mention that I can come across of unleavened bread. I find a lot of these stories in the Old Testament, I'm not so much concerned about Sodom and Gomorrah, what happened, we all know, whatever reason. I'm really interested in the characters of the Old Testament. The angels, the messengers, the people. It's fascinating. If you get caught up in the Sodom and Gomorrah story and think of the city of sin and all this and that, you're really missing, a more beautiful story of how the different characters and the angels of the Lord and different, how they interplayed in all of this. I think that's really, and that's some of what I'm going to do in Advent season. So that was the first mention of it. The Passover was also, as I said, a time of unleavened bread. What was Jesus so upset about the Pharisees about, the Pharisees and the Herodians? He said that you had to be aware of their yeast. So at this point in time, yeast had taken, or leaven has taken on a different meaning, or it grew to be something, it meant that it was false teachings, it was doing something wrong, it seems like Jesus in many different instances has picked on the leaders of the day, the Jewish leaders of the day, especially the Pharisees. And they were, the Pharisees and the Herodians. Well, Pharisees, I'll start with them first. They were the interpreters of the law. They would take the law and interpretate it, and they had all these midrashes. They had all this interpretation. Now, I have learned a lot in the last couple of weeks about the First and the Second Amendment. I went to the active shooter thing over there, as I said last Sunday a little bit, and I learned that, yes, I have a right to own a handgun. But I don't necessarily have the right to use it. That's where the interpretation of the law comes in. I have that right, but I cannot use it in a free way that you may think. I learned that precedent of the law, I hope I said that word, precedent, I have a hard time saying that. That's case law, basically in a simple word, is what defends you or does not defend you. That whole body of case law or precedent is where you understand what you have and how you can use it. I should have been the Second Amendment. The First Amendment is the freedom of speech. And I think I've learned that from a tape series that Bob gave me. It's the same way. I have the right to speak whatever I want, but case law dictates when and how and if. I have that right. So the same was true with the Pharisees. They understood the Ten Commandments. That's the body of law in which they would interpretate that all. They would make case law, so to speak, of the Mosaic law. And so Jesus would say, beware of them because they would try to manipulate the law. You know, in one hand you have the freedom of speech and the right to bear arms, but case law says what you can and can't do, and that's what the Pharisees would do. They would go around, find every little thing that they could find wrong with what people did, and you know, and say they were sinners and what have you. The Herodians, or the people of Herod, were people who supported King Herod of Antipas, and because they thought it was just expedient to do so, and they compromised the Jewish independence. They didn't. And the Pharisees and the Herodians did not get along for that reason. They couldn't agree on because the Pharisees wanted a Jewish independence. So they didn't get along. So there was a lot of stuff going on. So you can consider it today like the left and the right in the political field. They were opposites. They didn't get along. And so they had a lot of leaven that Jesus talked about. A lot of the things that you would really want to be aware of, they would try to persuade you different ways and get you on your side. They didn't agree on much of anything, but one of the things that they did agree on was getting rid of Jesus. That was one thing that they wanted to get rid of, because Jesus stood for something that they didn't. An interpretation of the law that was more loving and compassionate, which was based on loving God with all your heart and mind and soul, and loving your neighbor as yourself. These two groups and other groups were not necessarily interested in that. They were interested in their own demise. They had what Jesus would call, beware of their, watch out for their teaching. So leaven became teachings and understandings of what you understood. Now, we have the Lord's table set before us, and there has been a discussion, and maybe not here in this circle, whether you want leavened bread or unleavened bread, or you want wine, or you want grape juice. That has always been kind of a discussion. If you want, in my estimate, to have the best representation of what Christ is, or was, is, he still lives, so he is, then you would want leavened bread, and you would want wine. Why? Because Christ is the new leaven. This is where I get the idea that Jesus' teachings is an ingredient that is added to our souls and our spirit to make us more than what we are. That's what leaven does. Leaven makes a cracker a piece of bread. It makes us a living soul. It makes us much more than what we are. So Christ becomes the new leaven and the new ingredient that is to come, become in all of humanity. There's where you're not going to find a verse that says Christ is the new leaven. You have to read it into the text, and you have to understand the spirit of what's going on. It's not as plain as that as the nose on your face, but it is there. Because if leaven is a teachings, it has to do with, it doesn't necessarily have to do with just bad teachings. It also has to do with good teachings. It's an ingredient. No matter who we are, what we are leavened with something. We believe something. We hold something to be true. Whatever that is, that's your leaven. Whether I agree with it or disagree with it, we're all leavened. We all have something. So, and if Jesus becomes the new leaven, then we must use bread, raised bread, because Jesus makes us more than what we really are. He adds something to us, to what we are. Wine, again, seems like there was something else I wanted to say there, but I'll get back to it. Wine should be used because of the spirit. It's the fermenting in the spirit that we're more concerned with. We're concerned with the body of teachings that is feeds our soul and nourishes our mind and our spirit. That's what the bread or the new leaven is. It feeds us spiritually, and the wine represents the spirit. We call it spirits. You go to the store of spirits or whatever. You can have your choice of them. There's all kinds. I wondered if there's really actually a different spirit bottled in each one of them. Because it says spirits. It doesn't say, does it say spirit, or does it say store of spirits?
One spirit.
One spirit?
Spirits.
Spirits. Many spirits. Yes.
We should start to have a bottle of wine then, shouldn't
we? I understand why we're not going to, we don't do it because there's an issue of alcohol serving teenagers, and I don't, but you get a very low alcohol content. There is communion wine, and yes, if you really want the true intent of the Lord's table, you should have wine and you should have bread. Not a little wafer, not a little cracker, not a little rice thing, whatever. It should be bread. Now.
Will that, can you make a big loaf of unleavened bread?
No. You can make it this thick, but it's going to be hard as a rock. It's going to be a brick. So you make it like a cracker, so you can, the way the Jewish people make it, they make it, I think they mark it off in 12 lines, I think, this way. It's 12 lines this way and 12 lines this way, and then they break it like a cracker. That's how they eat it. Now, if you're taking a Seder Passover, there is, and this is where Jesus comes in. Jesus celebrated the Seder Passover without bread at the beginning. But when he got done, and at the end of a Seder meal, at the end of the Seder process, you have the herbs and the horseradish, and there's a bunch of things that are on it, and there's all different, a glass of wine between each one. There's a whole process. And at the end of that, you have a meal. Then Jesus, after that, took a loaf of bread and he broke it. It says bread. It does not say unleavened bread. It says bread in all text. This is what, and Jesus added to the Seder process or fulfilled it. So it says in the story that they were reclining after lunch. So after dinner, I think dinner was probably a little different than what we have. They would eat bits and pieces and they would recline after the Seder process, Passover. And then Jesus took a loaf of bread and he added something new. He fulfilled the Seder meal and the Passover. And he became the Passover. And he used bread. It says bread in every case. Now, some people can argue, they'll argue, no matter what I say, someone can say something that, okay, that's their leaven. Go have fun. But it says bread in all cases. And we should always use a bread. We take a loaf of bread and we break it. That's what the Bible says. He took a loaf of bread and broke it. He broke his body for us. And that has to be, in my opinion, leaven. Jesus was so disgusted with his disciples because they couldn't see with their spiritual eyes and understand with their spiritual ears. They only wanted to see the physical reality around them. And he was so upset at them, and I can understand, and he's trying to teach a bunch of hard-headed men how to think differently. And we talked about different out here in Sunday school. Different thinking and trying to get people to think different, good luck. It's not as easy as what you might think. People are traditionalists. They won't want to change. They like the groove that they're in. And I'm probably just as guilty as the rest of us. But I think I can change a little bit. Don't I? A little? Sometimes. I'm not as resistant as I once was, that's for sure. But you try to get people to change and try to learn, teach them something. There's teachers here. You know how hard it is to teach and to get to absorb into their head and to understand. And Jesus' frustration really comes out here in this passage. He's frustrated. He's like, what's wrong with you people? And I think that is our case in many times. We're stuck in our physical reality and all we see is the physical things. I shouldn't say all, but a lot of times. We're stuck in that reality. Scientists, as far as I'm concerned, when they look at a molecule, what do they see? They see the matter bits flying around the molecule. They're more concerned about the matter parts, and that's only a very small percentage of a molecule. There's so much space in between, we don't know what that space is or what that energy is. That energy inside that molecule, that dark matter, dark energy, is what's pushing that matter around, but they're concerned about that physical little bit, electrons and protons and what all the rest of them. There's some more. I forget.
Neutrons.
They're more concerned about that than they are about what's in the space. This pulpit, everything around us, has less matter in it than does space. But what do we see? All we see is the pulpit. We see people, we see. You yourself and I have less, we have more space than we do matter. But what do we see? We only see ourselves.
Space is just open. I mean, you can't say, oh, look at that.
Look at space.
you know.
That's true, but you have to understand what's there. We don't understand what's there. That's what my point. We used to think of space as empty, as nothing. But now we're saying, no, it's not nothing. It's something there, but we don't know what it is. Dark energy and dark matter is something we don't understand. Even quantums and what have you, I have not heard what they know what that is. And what I found interesting, I watched a Science Channel one day, and this little probe that was sent out in 1970-something, it was only supposed to last for 2 to 5 years, 3 to 5 years. And that little sucker is still ticking way out there, and it's going way on out there, and they're learning a tremendous amount. And that the interplay of our galaxy with everything else, that there's not necessarily an end or a beginning. This galaxy is affected by this galaxy. And what amazed me was how these scientists talked in terms of, like the Earth is stealing this, and like it was almost like they were beings, like Earth was a being, this galaxy was a being. They talked in terms, it was almost like Greek mythology. I could see it just as plain as day. And my question is, we still don't know what manipulates, moves, and what forces, what gods, what have you. Whatever term you want to use is moving these things around. We just look at a planet. Yep, it goes around. And I'm almost to the point where I say a galaxy is like a molecule. Galaxies are things going around a nucleus, around a sun. Is this all a living being in which we're living in? It's an interesting idea. Anyway, there's a lot of questions, little answers sometimes. My question as I move into and I'm going to close with this, is that, again, if you were God living in an outside galaxy somewhere, how would you go about giving humanity an understanding? What was that question I asked? Anyway, how would you send a message to us earthlings? How would you go about doing it? And then how would you teach us, Dan?
Probably the fire and the floods and everything, we're getting out of the message.
The what? The fires?
The floods and everything.
Yeah, but are we listening?
No.
And it's almost like you can almost see like the gods are at war. You know, with the fires and the rains and the snow. You can almost see that part of a great hierarchy at play. I mean, I do. And I believe in a hierarchy. And I'm not going to... I'm going to close with this. Paul says, and he writes, that a little leaven leavens the whole lump. So it only takes a little bit to really affect everything. And I should have said this. Anybody here heard about the 99th monkey syndrome? I'm sure people have. And it was an experiment. I see some frowns, so I'll say what it was. There was a scientist who went on an island somewhere, and he one of the experiments that he wanted to do was to see how many monkeys he could train before all the monkeys did some certain thing. And so he taught this one monkey how to wash his food, go down to the water and wash his food. And he began to teach another one. And that monkey taught another one. And once it reached a critical mass of 99, I think that's what it is, I don't know about 99, but once it reached a certain amount of numbers, which wasn't very much, it suddenly all the monkeys did the same thing. They all went down and washed their food in the water. So the question is, it doesn't take, and scientists know this, it doesn't take 50% to change the world. It only takes a small percentage. The 99 monkey syndrome is in play. So how many people and how many beings, and at what point is this earth going to flip and become a spiritual reality? What would it take? See you next Sunday.
Joy, 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 overflowing. trusting and true. This is our gift for you.
Please help us to use these gifts to bring help and healing to a world weary with all kinds of division. In your name, amen.